Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Ever since the announcement 2 weeks ago that after we finish 2 Samuel, that our midweek services or midweek lessons are going to turn to theology proper, and that I'm going to begin teaching systematics here on Wednesday nights. Ever since that announcement, I've been getting all sorts of very good, very positive feedback, not only from folks on the internet who are looking forward to hearing it and have already been asking what's the syllabus and, you know, what reading should we be doing and which books will you be using, and I don't know, people, back off. And I'm working on it. I have several systematics that I like, and I'm going to be kind of coalescing a bunch of different things. But not only on the internet, but folks at GCA have been quite enthused about it, which is good, but it was also a reminder to me that we live in a very interesting time where it certainly seems like as much purported Christianity as there is in America. And as long as Christianity has held sway here in these United States, you would think that there would be so much biblical and Christian knowledge within the population that we could spend large amounts of our time in the church world teaching the finer points of sound doctrine. You would think that we'd be grown up and matured enough as a nation of people that we would be able to do that. No, the amount of ignorance that runs absolutely rampant in the Christian world is just overwhelming and stunning and astounding nonstop. And so I think that's one of the reasons that people are enthused about the idea of let's go back and talk about these very, very foundational, very fundamental concepts that are going to start with the Bible is the Word of God, which, by the way, is the theme of the message, the lecture, that I'll be bringing at the conference in a couple of weeks in Gladeville. The more that I have begun thinking about this topic, the more I've realized that it's kind of going to be the theme for most of 2013 for me, I do believe. Certainly it's what we're going to be teaching on Wednesdays, but I'm going to be carrying it. What was that? Was that go team? She gave me a woo-woo kind of hand motion there. I'm not sure what that was about. But yeah, I am convinced. This is just weighing on me. It's almost like God has put this on my shoulders and said, this is what you're about right now. It's time to go back and teach the foundations of Christianity. And it's to some degree kind of a shame that we have to do that. But it's also advantageous because we as a church that have been around now for a number of years, I think I started out by doing the fundamentals and teaching foundational things like 8 years ago, was it? Maybe 9 years ago when I taught through the doctrines of grace. And I've just sort of assumed ever since then that because that material is available and on our website, I just sort of assume that folks know it. But especially the young folk. That was BG before Gladys? Well, it would be. It was that long ago. BG. I like that. Gladys came up with BG. And so I'm looking forward to doing it, and I'm glad that there's that kind of enthusiasm for it, and the young folk are quite interested. So I was asked the other day, well, when are you going to start it? And I think we'll begin after the conference. We're going to try to finish up 2 Samuel, and then obviously we're not going to meet the Wednesday of the conference, because the conference is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and that is March 12th, 13th, 14th, I believe. 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, something like that. And so that week we won't be meeting midweek, and when we get back, that's when we will hopefully start this. Now, I had a conversation a couple of years ago with a young man out on the left coast. And let's be honest, it's where he belonged. In the conversation, he was decrying Christianity in general. And of course, he was taking a very Darwinistic approach to the existence of human life and the existence of all life. And one of his arguments was that because evolution had been going on for so long that it just seemed to him axiomatic that human beings today are better, smarter, more intelligent, more moral, if he could use that word, certainly more ethical than previous generations, simply by virtue of the fact that that's the way Darwinistic evolution would work. If it did work, that's how it would work, that human beings would be gradually improving as we got rid of those parts of ourselves that were not beneficial and continued reduplicating the beneficial parts of us. And so he was arguing that the evidence that we're better than we used to be, certainly smarter than we used to be, was computers, that we now have computers so that we have access to all of this information. And I said, so you're really arguing that just because there's a tool that does our thinking for us, that that somehow means we're smarter? Well, yes, because we humans created this tool. And I said, yes, and how do the vast majority of human beings use that tool? Do they use it for the purpose of educating themselves? No. Or improving themselves? No. How are they spending their time? They're watching kitty videos. Or, and Carol just said it, pornography. It's astounding the way human beings have used that tool as yet another demonstration of our own degeneracy. If you just go and you read the sort of comments that are on the end of every news article or every video or every... You don't see intellectual debate happening.
You don't see civility.
You don't see civility, right. So now I said all that to say, one of the things that he argued is that human beings are now somehow more ethical than they used to be. And he said, you know, back in the Old Testament, you see all these examples of war and bloodshed and destruction and killing and, you know, and I said, really, you don't see that now? Are you? We just have better tools to do it with. But he said, yeah, back in those days, you know, they'd be likely to cut off your head. Well, that phrase stuck in my head. Back in those days, they'd be likely to cut off your head. Yesterday, a video broke on the internet of Syrian rebels hacking off a guy's head, hacking off two people's heads. And the video is on the internet. You can watch it. It's horrid. It's graphic. I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I watched enough of it to get right up to the edge of when the actual event was about to begin, just so I could see the method they were using. The method was phenomenally inhumane, absolutely brutal. Now, I said that to say, the next chapter that we're about to read out of 2 Samuel, chapter 20, includes a beheading. And people who want to argue against the Bible will point at a chapter like this and say, look how barbaric that is. That was those people way back then. But we're so much better and so much smarter now. We've grown so far. Which is also, by the way, just logically a funny argument, because the difference between David and us, it's about 3,000 years. And if you're talking about Darwinistic evolution, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the millions of years they have to postulate for actual evolution to occur. So the duration of human evolution over the last 3,000 years would be very minute compared to the length of time it takes for something to actually evolve. So it's really a kind of a pointless argument anyway, but still, it's so typical of them to say, oh, those people way back then. And as I was preparing to bring this passage to our attention tonight, I saw the news and the video yesterday of the beheading of two people over there in the Middle East, in the same place where this beheading in 2 Samuel takes place. Nothing's changed, because as long as there are human beings, then there's sinfulness, then there's depravity, then there's hatred, then there's killing, then there's people doing horrible things to other people, because that's the human condition. Evidence yet again that depravity is a genuine, provable, demonstrable biblical doctrine. You can look at human beings and say, they're depraved, and look at the Bible, and the Bible says humans are depraved, and you go, well, yeah, yes. It's always encouraging to me when I talk to anybody. I remember sitting talking to a drug addict one time, And, you know, I start every conversation about Christ with human beings are depraved and they're sinful and they need help. And I didn't get halfway through that spiel before he went, well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was a guy I thought, no, I got something to tell you. I can help you out because I don't even have to argue with you about the fact that humans are just no darn good. But way too much of modern Christianity says human beings are good. It starts with the concept, the idea that humans are essentially capable. Humans are essentially good. And when something bad happens, like the beheading I'm talking about, they think of that as an aberration. But it's an almost unexplainable aberration to their way of thinking. But it's not unexplainable. It's happening as a direct result of Sharia law sweeping through the Middle East and Egypt right now. It's a direct correlation to the religion that they are adhering to. It's in fact very explainable, and it's explainable on the basis of humans are just that corrupt that they will create a religion like this. Thanks. In direct opposition not only to Christianity, but what is the focus of Islamic religion? Get rid of Israel. Mm-hmm. Get rid of Israel. That's the focus.
The focus is submission. You are submit to us.
It is a mission, absolutely. If you have a biblical worldview at all, then you see that the Bible wrote about this kind of stuff in excess of 3,000 years ago, going all the way back to Abraham in the tent with Hagar and producing Ishmael. There's no way to understand what's happening in the world. There's no way to understand human beings or human behavior. And there's no way to understand the geopolitical world on the planet right now if you don't understand your Bible. The Bible is the only place where you find actual, consistent information about what's going on in the world right now. And that's why you have all the hand-wringing and machinations going on in places like Washington trying to figure out what to do about this. And then they, again, proving utter depravity, then they make all the wrong, stupid decisions where this is concerned because they're just as depraved as their enemies. And so everybody is just continually making wrong, bad, destructive decisions because we're so much smarter now than we were 3,000 years ago. No, we're not. We're exactly the same. Chapter 20, 2 Samuel. You may recall that David is in the process of crossing over the Jordan. He's on his way back into Jerusalem, taking him back to the area of Judah. You may remember, we talked about last week, that there was a bit of consternation, a bit of an argument between Israel, the northern tribes, and Judah, the southern tribes. And they even argued, don't we own 10/12 of David? I mean, after all, we're 10 parts to your 2. So they were claiming David as their king, and yet look how quickly they revolt against him yet again. Now remember, and this is an important thing, remember that every one of these revolts happened in the northern kingdom and usually have a family member of Saul somewhere involved, the idea that the heritage of the first king, Saul, is the heritage that could be enthroned again to counter David's rulership. Hang on to that because that'll become important when we get to chapter 21, which I'm hoping to do tonight if I'll just start reading and stop pontificating. Pontiff. I use the word pontificating. By the way, the Pope's quitting, and there's a movement I just read about today among the feminist Catholics who were saying this would be an opportune time to have a female Pope. None.
Details, so, details.
Yeah. They were saying a nun. Give a nun the pontificate. Which then, of course, they'd have to change the name because Pope is Papa. So she'd be the mom. She'd be the mama. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to happen because everybody who's in charge over there is male and they've been vying for that position and those political things have been going on for years and years and years. So it's not going to happen. But of course, you know, there's always going to be some, okay, pontificating. I'm going to stop that now. But that's what made me think of it. Okay, we're moving on.
Baby steps.
Baby steps. a worthless fellow happened to be there, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. He blew the trumpet, which was a way of gathering the people, and he said, "We have no portion in David." Now, this is a direct result of the earlier argument back in verse 43 of chapter 19. The men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "We have 10 parts in the king. Therefore, we also have more claim on David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back the king?" Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel, which means they responded to them so harshly that this guy Sheba then says, "We have no portion then with David. Forget it. We're just going to take our ball and go home. Forget it. Nor do we have any inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." And so the northern tribes are now denouncing David. Well, David thinks that he's finally cleared up the rebellion in his own household, but now there's a new rebellion stirring in the northern tribes against him. So all the men of Israel, says verse 2, withdrew from following David, and they followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. Then David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, the concubines, whom he had left to keep the house. You remember those women? Those are the ones that his son slept with in a tent up on the roof. And he did the proper thing with them. He placed them under guard so that they couldn't get to any other men, provided them with sustenance, which means gave them a place to live and gave them food, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living like widows. Then the king said to Amasa, "Call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself." So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which he had appointed him. Apparently it took more than 3 days to get everybody together. Verse 6, and David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom did. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape from our sight." So Joab's men went out after him, along with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men, and they went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. When they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was dressed in his military attire, and over that was a belt with a sword in its sheath, fastened at its waist, and as he went forward, it fell out. So the sword fell out. What you're going to find out in a minute is that he apparently also picked it up, but it explains why it was in his hand to begin with. Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him, but Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand, so he struck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground and did not strike him again, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now there stood by one of Joab's young men, who said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." And apparently because this happened in a highway, on a street, the young man stood up and said, "Come on, everybody who's for David," he's now getting the people who had been following, chasing after Amasa, he's now getting them to change sides and come with Joab, but there's a dead body in the road, and they wouldn't pass the dead body. Verse 12, but Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the men saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him when he saw that everyone who came by him would stand still. As soon as he was removed from the highway, all the men passed on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now he went through all the tribes of Israel, to Abel, even to Beth-Makkah, and to all the Barites, and they were gathered together, and they also went after him. And they came and they besieged him in Abel-Beth-Makkah. and they cast up a mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. Now, what that's describing is, you have to understand this. Let's say this is a city wall, okay? And all the people who are in the city are in here. There's all these people in here. Say this wall, very high and very thick, goes all the way around the city. Well, what they would do is they would start building a rampart. And what a rampart was a whole bunch of rocks. They'd bring rocks and stones and things, and they would just keep building them and just putting them up and putting them up like this, so that little by little they'd be able to reach the top of it and get over the wall. That's what the rampart was. A poorly built wall would fall under the weight and the onslaught of this rampart. But what we just read was that the walls actually held against it. They came and they besieged him at Abel Beth Ma'akah, and they cast up a mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart, and all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. They're trying to take down the wall, but it's standing, it's doing fine. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Here, here, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you." So he approached her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." Then she said, "Listen to the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I'm listening." Then she spoke, saying, "Formerly they used to say, they will surely ask advice at Abel, and thus they would end a dispute." In other words, she's saying, we're a place of peace. When two sides would have a dispute, they would come here to settle the dispute. When armies or kings would argue, this is a place where they would come and meet. This was Geneva. You know, they'd come and work these things out. And she said, I'm one of those, verse 19, who is peaceable and faithful in Israel. You're seeking to destroy a whole city, even a mother in Israel. That's an interesting phrase. The first place that you find the phrase mother in Israel is all the way back in the book of Judges. And you remember Deborah? Deborah the judge? She's the first person in the Bible referred to as a mother in Israel. So basically what she's saying is, I'm one of those faithful women like Deborah who helps to bring about sound judgment and keep peace in Israel. And you're about to destroy my city, my household. You might even kill me. You're destroying a city and a mother in Israel. I'm a peacemaker in Israel. And you're about to destroy all of this. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? And Joab answered and said, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Such is not the case. But a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city. And the woman, the wise woman, the mother in Israel woman, said, behold, his head will be thrown over the wall to you. This is a wise woman, but apparently also a fairly cutthroat woman. Ooh, and that was a good use of the word cutthroat. Oh, see, you liked that, didn't you? So, here's what happened. The woman wisely, see the next word? The woman wisely came to all the people. So she must have at some point explained to them, look, there's an army outside that has been very successful, and they're going to topple our city, they're going to topple the wall, they're going to come in and just start killing everybody because they're looking for one guy, and he's from the hill country. He's not even one of us. He's just here. What do you say we just give them him, and they'll go away? And they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it over the wall to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent. Joab also returned to the king at Jerusalem. So it turns out she actually did negotiate a peace. She actually did bring about an end, a solution to it. This is why it's very interesting to me, and why I made the introductory comments that I did today, is that this bit of head cutting is said in the Bible to have been wise. She wisely went and spoke to the people. She's called a wise woman. And she brought about peace by cutting a head off.
He was a troublemaker in Israel.
He was against the king. And so she didn't just hand him over. They tossed the head over. There you go. Now what we saw in the news yesterday and in the video on the internet was also a beheading, and there was no wisdom in it at all. It was rampant violence drawn by hatred. And yet these are the kind of things that people say, here's my example, that we now today are so much better. That we as human beings, as a species, have graduated so dramatically. We're so much better than they used to be. Again, there's no evidence that we're any better whatsoever, certainly not more moral, certainly not more ethical, at least back here at this particular moment. This woman did this to bring about peace and sacrificed one person to save many, many people. The current people who are doing it to incite violence. They're doing it to bring about a greater trouble and struggle and jihad. If you really, really compare the details of the Bible and you compare the details of modern day life, there's no evidence anywhere that we're any better than they were back then. Have I driven that point home? Okay. Verse 23. Now Joab was over the whole army of Israel, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and Adoram was over the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, and Sheva was the scribe, Zadok and Abiathar were the priests, and Ira the Jerite was also the priest to David. Chapter 21. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the presence of the Lord. It seems odd to me, to begin with, that it took 3 years for David to go seek the Lord. Anytime there was an event like this, they always knew that it was the sovereignty of God that had brought about these events. So perhaps he thought that the first couple of years were some kind of punishment by God for the wars that had been taking place in and around Israel. Perhaps that's what they thought. I'm just guessing here. But it took 3 years for David to finally go to the Lord and say, now what is this about? Now of the many things that it might have been about, I find it fascinating that God says this. The Lord said, it's because of Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death. Okay, now think with me for a moment. First off, Saul's been dead a long time. Secondly, you can read the account of Saul in the Bible, and you don't read anything about him attacking the Gibeonites. However, here's what we do know. Look up Joshua 9. Keep your finger where you are here in 2 Samuel and go to Joshua 9. As the children of Israel were entering into the promised land, there was a covenant formed between Israel and the Gibeonites. Chapter 9, verse 3 says, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily, and they sent out as envoys, and they took worn out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended, and worn out and patched sandals on their feet, and worn out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. And they went to Joshua to the camp of Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, we have come from a far country, now therefore make a covenant with us. Now they live in the area. You may remember this when we studied it a while ago. Even though they lived in the area, they made it look like they had come from far away. And they made their clothes look old, they made their sandals look old, made their food look worn out. And they came and said, we came from a far country, and you guys are really great, so make a covenant with us. So that once Israel made a covenant with them, they could say, okay, now we're your next door neighbors, but you made a promise. So they did it through subterfuge, but, verse 7, the men of Israel said to the Hivites, perhaps you are living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you? But they said to Joshua, we are your servants. Then Joshua said to them, who are you and where do you come from? And they said to him, your servants have come from a very far country. because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard the report of him and what he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, and to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, the king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go and meet with them, and say to them, we are your servants, now then make a covenant with us. This, our bread, was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on that day that we left to come to you. And now, behold, it's dry and it's become crumbled. And these wineskins, which were filled and were new, and behold, they are torn. And these, our clothes and our sandals, are worn out because of this very long journey. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them and let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. And it came about at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Now, several interesting details there. First off, they made a deal through subterfuge. The reason they got away with it was Joshua didn't bother to check with God. These were part of the people groups that God had originally told Israel, drive them out of your land. They didn't check with God. They did make a deal, and it took 3 days before the truth came out. Go back to 2 Samuel. There was a famine. It took 3 years for the truth to come out. I just find that interesting. At the end of 3 years, David goes to God and says, what is this about? And God says, well, this is about the Gibeonites. Oh, you mean those people that Joshua made a deal with way back then? This is about them? And God says, it's because of Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death. Now, like I said, we don't read about that particular event, but we know about it because of it being recorded here in 2 Samuel, that apparently Saul put to death Gibeonites after this deal had been made back in the time of Joshua. Now, this is a very long memory God's got going. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now, the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of a remnant of the Amorites. And the sons of Israel made a covenant with them. But Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? And how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? David now has to go to the Gibeonites, who were originally enemies, who nevertheless had a pact, a covenant with Israel, a covenant that Saul broke. Saul's now dead. All Israel suffered for 3 years because of it. And now David has to go to the Gibeonites and say, what's it going to take for you to bless Israel so that we can have rain? What's this going to take? They say, we have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house. In other words, we don't want money for it. Nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. And he said, I will do for you whatever you say. So they said, look, we're foreigners here, so we don't have the right to put anybody to death in Israel. We're going to need your help with this, king. We don't want silver and gold, but we can't kill anybody. And David says, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. So they said to the king, the man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within the border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I'll give them to you. So now, what's really going on here? What's behind? What'd you say?
Racial
discrimination? To some degree. But remember that when Israel came into the land in the first place, they were told to drive all these people out. And they didn't check with God, which is why they ended up making the covenant with him. In a moment, I'm going to read what he did, because he does do everything that they ask. He's going to give up 7 of Saul's children. But all of this seems very random until you reach all the way back to the book of Numbers and you read parts of the original law of how Israel was to treat the land when they were in it. In Numbers 35, 33, it says, "So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it." Now that rule exists and is standing in Israel when Saul went in and killed the Gibeonites, who apparently were at rest or at peace with the Israelites because they had a covenant that they had made all the way back there with Joshua. Saul goes in and breaks the covenant and sheds blood in the land of Israel. And now there has to be an atonement made for that shed blood in order to purify the land. And that blood has to be the blood of the one who was responsible for it in the first place. The idea is that blood from unpunished murders defiles the land, and God will one day require that blood from that nation. So here's what happens. Verse 7, David said, "I'm going to give them to you, but the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul." That's one guy named Mephibosheth. In a moment, you're going to see another fellow named Mephibosheth. But the one who specifically was the son of Jonathan, he spared him because he had made a covenant with him. And so for David to break that covenant and give that guy up would just be compounding the problem. So the son of Jonathan, who eats at the king's table, he spared him. And he did that because of the oath of the Lord that was between them, between David and Saul's son Jonathan. So the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. The two sons were named Armoni and Mephibosheth, whom she had borne to Saul. So they were direct sons of Saul. And five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had borne to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Maholathite. And then he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountain before the Lord, so that the seven of them fell together, and they were put to death on the first days of harvest at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now that tells you that it was happening in the spring, happening fairly early in the calendar year. That's important because now we're going to talk about what Rizpah, their mother, did. But look at what else has happened here. This is a great example of God's phenomenal compatibilism, and I don't want us to miss it. Where's the problem? Where's the trouble coming from in David's kingship at this moment? It's coming from the northern tribes and from people who keep wanting to put a descendant of Saul on the throne. So in the process of atoning for the blood that Saul spilled, God uses that to destroy the remaining sons of Saul so that there can be no more rebellion against David from the house of Saul. Really interesting. God, in his providence, securing David once and for all on the throne of Israel, because after all, God knows that he has already made this covenant with David. He's always going to have a seed sitting on the throne of Israel. This is a promise from God, and the trouble keeps coming from the northern tribes who keep trying to enthrone a descendant of Saul. So God uses this moment to eliminate the problem. Fascinating. Then verse 10, Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until it rained on them from the sky. And she allowed neither the birds of the sky to rest on them by day, nor the beast of the fields by night. Only two of the seven that are hanging there are her sons. And she goes out in the field, puts down sackcloth, sits down, and doesn't leave there as long as her boys are hanging from the tree. And when the birds come to try to eat from the dead bodies, she chases the birds off. At night, she protects the bodies from the wild animals that would try to eat them. This is the love that this mother has for her sons. It's a remarkable demonstration of a mother's love. When it was told to David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the open square in Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day that the Philistines struck down Saul in Gilboa. And he brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from there, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin in Zelah, in the grave of Kish his father. Thus they did all that the king commanded. In other words, finally, all the disparate family members, starting with Saul and with Jonathan and these that were hung, were all brought back to Benjamin, put in a common grave where they belonged, and in so doing, cleansed the land. And the next thing you read is, and after that, God was moved by entreaty for the land. And notice how long Rizpah sat there? From the spring and the barley harvest until it rained, which means she stayed there until God brought rain and the land had been essentially redeemed and cleansed again. And by the way, what moved David? What inspired David to do the right proper thing in gathering the bones and bringing them back to Benjamin? One woman and her devotion to her kids. A mother's love even moves a king and ends up in the redemption of the whole land of Israel. It is a good picture of the mother in Israel, absolutely. Verse 15, now when the Philistines were at war with Israel, David went down and his servants with him, and as they fought against the Philistines, David became weary. Now David's getting older. David's moving on. When we get to the end of 2 Samuel, the beginning of 1 Kings is really about the waning and the last days of David and Solomon moving into his kingship. So what we're reading now is really the end of David's illustrious career. But you'll like these last few verses because they're about giants, so you'll enjoy this. Then Ishbi-Benob, who was among the descendants of the giant, that's Goliath, the one that David killed, the weight of whose spear was 300 shekels of bronze in weight, was girded with a new sword, and he intended to kill David. Why? Because David had killed his dad. So now David has another problem. The giants are after him. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, helped him and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall not go out again with us to battle, that you may not extinguish the lamp of Israel." In other words, they're saying to David, you can't keep coming out into these battles because once they know you're here, they hone in on you. And if you're gone, that's the light of Israel. So you need to just stay behind from now on. You're getting old. Stay at home. Don't come into the battle anymore. Verse 18, now it came about after this that there was war again with the Philistines at Gob. Then Zibbekai the Hushathite struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the giant. And there was war with the Philistines again at Gob. And Elhanan, the son of Jeori-Oregim, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was war at Gath again, where there was a man of great stature who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, 24 in number. And he also had been born to the giant. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, who was David's brother, struck him down. These 4 were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. I remember hearing a preacher years ago teaching on David and Goliath, and one of the more interesting little details that you read about the David and Goliath story is that when David finally did go confront Goliath after he took Saul's armor off. It says that he had his sling in his pocket and he went to the stream and he took out 5 smooth stones. Why 5? Well, one of the things that the preacher said years ago that I just always remembered, and I don't know if it's true or not, but what we just read said he had 4 relatives who were also giants. So who knows? 5 is also the number of grace in the Bible. It might very well be that David thought maybe he was going to need 5. Turns out he only needed 1. But it might also be that he figured one apiece for five giants. Who knows? Now, starting next week, we're going to look at chapter 22, which is a very long psalm. And we're going to read that psalm, and we're going to compare it to Psalm 18, which is also a very long psalm. And then chapter 23 is David's last song, or his last psalm. And then there's a recitation of his mighty men. And then we get to the last chapter, which, interestingly enough, way back when we began 1 and 2 Samuel, I talked about the census that David took. So it's just fascinating stuff. Any questions about that tonight? We're good? All right.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.